I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Economic Development to order for Monday, January 28, 2019. First, I'll be opening an informational hearing meeting. The purpose of today's informational meeting is to provide the committee with a better understanding of the state funding or tax expenditures for economic development. Just for everybody's information on all this, we have a compilation of budget information for economic development program areas, including 2017-19 legislative adopted budget, 2019-21 current service level pie charts by agency and fund type, 2017-19 budget highlights section for economic development, and the 2017-19 legislative adopted budget detail for economic development agencies. Today we have Chris Alanek with the Legislative Revenue Office. Will give us an overview of LRO and the tax expenditures for economic development. Chris, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Alanek, the Legislative Revenue Office. And so, to that point, just to highlight what I was going to be touching on, Melissa and I, we were talking about this in terms of what would be most beneficial for the committee. I was just going to come and provide basically an overview of LRO, as well as how we might be able to help the committee do its business this session. And to that end, LRO consists, I think some people on the committee are familiar with LRO and some people aren't. We are the office that assigns the revenue impact statements. We create the revenue impact statements for every bill that goes through the process. So that's our core tangible function. To do that, the office consists of about six economists, and we're structured, generally speaking, by tax program. So we have one person working on property taxes, one person working on the personal income tax, and another economist working on the corporate income tax. And then we have another person handling miscellaneous taxes, such as the marijuana tax. And it sounds like the committee is likely to touch on all of those at one point or another. So this is just to partly let you be aware of how we can tap in. And the real question, or the topic for how we can tap in there, is how tax policy intersects with economic development policy. And to that end, economic development is, as the committee is aware, is a very broad topic. It deals with community development, access to markets, whether you're talking about labor markets or labor supply or access to capital. It deals with regulation, and then a piece of that is tax policy, and it touches these in different ways. One way that it touches it is with the direct taxation. So for the most part, we're talking about the income tax and the property tax. Those are the two dominant revenue streams in the state. And one policy, as an example of how that policy can get debated over several sessions, for corporate income taxes, for corporations that operate in multiple states, there is the question of how much of that income can be taxed by Oregon. And we currently use a single sales factor. And back in the day, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, we had an equally weighted formula where for a corporation that had nexus in Oregon, meaning Oregon has the right to tax that corporation, our starting point is federal taxable income. So we look at the corporation, what is their federal taxable income, and then Oregon gets to tax some piece of that. And the question is how much? And for the longest time, it was an equally weighted factor where we looked at the share of Oregon sales, or the Oregon share of sales in the US, Oregon share of payroll, and Oregon share of property. And it was an equally weighted formula. Much of the debate in, I think it was into the 90s and even into the early aught years, was about moving to a single sales factor formula. Now, from the tax policy standpoint, that was expected to generate slightly more stable revenue, but the idea was to focus on sales coming into Oregon, so it helped exporters. And so that we've been at a single sales factor for 10 years or so. So that's an example of a direct structure of a tax and how that can affect economic development. A lot of the argument for that was based on economic development grounds. And then The other piece, which gets to the tax expenditures, kind of the other side of the ledger, are the exceptions to the tax. And here we talk about tax expenditures, which in even in and of itself, that the notion of a tax expenditure can be somewhat controversial. But it is the idea of a certain income or property that is exempt from tax. And so to that, with that in mind, the handout that I had in OLIS is the listing of the current economic development tax incentives that are affecting the 1921 budget. This is taken from the governor's tax expenditure report, which is put together by the Department of Revenue. And they go through and try to group these for policy-wise. They put all of this information together. It's a brief book of only about 400 pages. And so they go through all of the tax expenditures. And the categories for these types of tax expenditures are helpful to keep in mind because our...
Representative Helm, did you have a question?
I didn't want to interrupt you, Chris, but can we go back to the single sales factor before we get too far? And for my benefit and one of my constituents' benefits, it might be interesting for everyone on the committee to hear, because we get this question quite a bit about single sales factor with respect to Nike. And by that, I mean that we have a history of the governor and Nike working out a deal many years ago that helped Nike stay where they are. And I think it is incorrectly perceived to be a special deal that only Nike gets. And my understanding is it's not so special with respect to the application of single sales factor. And if you could shed some light onto that, I'd be appreciative.
Sure. Chair Lively, Representative Helm, I do get that question a lot, and it's perceived to be a lock as to the level of taxes that the company would pay or the agreement that gets for the company where the governor enters into that agreement. And that's not correct. It's really just a lock on the form, the apportionment method. The single sales factor apportionment method, so what that means is companies that have that agreement with the governor, they're just going to stay at the single sales factor apportionment method, which is what applies to all companies. And that was kind of a holdover, I think, in some of the debates about moving to that policy. But it is just on the method of apportionment. It's not a level of tax.
If I'm understanding that correctly, then what that... So from the standpoint of their tax obligation to the state, that is their tax, the single sales, versus that we could do something else. So if we decided to look for other revenues, that we somehow could tax them in a different form in addition to the single sales tax.
Correct, Chair. The value of that agreement is that if we moved away from the single sales, kept everything the same except moved away from the single sales factor and went back to an equally weighted factor, then that wouldn't apply.
Right.
But as long as we're at the single sales factor, that's what it is. That's the policy of the state.
Thank you. Representative Verrett, I'll take
it. Mr. Chair, yeah, but they tied that up for 20 or 30 years, didn't they, along with Intel?
Chair Lively, Representative Barreto, I believe so. I believe 25 years. I'm not mm-hmm. sure of the exact details of the agreements.
Yeah. Can I ask Paul?
Sure, go ahead.
So the other thing I was wondering about that single sales factor is if, one, they just pay tax on what they sell here in Oregon, do they have to fill out a tax return for every other state? Or, you know, say they just had, you know, half of the states where they did other business and paid taxes in those, do they have to go all 50 states and fill out a tax return?
For any multi-state company, if they, now for the 50 states, about not all of them have an income tax. The tax structures vary. But if we're talking about the income tax, they would have to file a return in any state in which they had nexus. So if a company operated in all 50 states, then they would file a tax return in all 50 states.
So when we talk about operating, do they have to have an office or a place of doing business that does receive income at that particular location? And if not, then would Oregon then count whatever they sell at that state as income, you know, for Oregon to tax?
So a couple things there, Representative Barreto. The nexus is just, it is a, it's not always a crystal clear concept, but it's really a connection and the ability for a state, if there's some sort of presence, physical presence, often usually triggers nexus. We also have notions of economic nexus nowadays. And I'm not sure exactly where all the states are on economic nexus. But one piece that you've touched on is something called throwback sales. And so if a corporation is operating in different states and they're making sales into a state in which they don't have nexus, then those sales could be thrown back into Oregon and would be considered Oregon sales.
Chris, can you bend that microphone a little closer to you? Yeah, thank you.
There. Sorry about
that.
See
if that helps. No, that's all right. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Tax expenditures. So the handout that is in OLIS is just taken from the tax expenditure report. And it has basically three tax programs there, the income tax, the property tax, and other taxes. Now, these get categorized as economic development, and there's a program area. The Department of Revenue is tasked with assigning, identifying all of these tax expenditures and then assigning them to program areas. And so that's an imperfect process, and there's a lot of judgment there. So the ones that I grabbed here are just the ones identified as economic development right now. Is that too close?
It's not doing well today. It's not your fault. I don't know what's going on with it.
So the categories for the tax expenditures are key. Our income tax system, we are closely tied to federal law. So a lot of provisions or tax expenditures or incentives that are in federal law, we are already tied to and we pick up in Oregon law. And in that handout, the terminology there where we're talking about an exclusion or deduction, those are federal policies that by dint of us tying to federal taxable income, we pick up those policies. So we can disconnect from those. That is a policy choice by the state. So the default is to accept all of those. And then the other ones, we have a subtraction and a credit are the two main ones. A subtraction is the Oregon term for a deduction. It's basically income that is not taxed. So that gets pulled out and then we calculate the taxes. And the tax credit is a dollar for dollar reduction in tax.
Excuse me, Representative Kuehn.
Thank you so much, Chair Lively. Why do you list them separately on here as a deduction and some a subtraction? That just seems confusing to me when they are the same thing. Did I hear you say that correctly?
Chair Lively, Representative McEwen, it's challenging to talk about these without being confusing.
That's why we're all looking at you like this.
Part of that is where they show up in the tax code. And for the revenue committee members, they get immersed in this language. And if it's a subtraction, we can point to the Oregon statute that shows here's where it is, here's where it is. Oregon has decided to not tax something that the feds do tax.
Okay.
Whereas a deduction is the feds have said, we're not going to tax that. And Oregon hasn't really commented on it specifically, but because we're tied to federal taxable income, it affects us.
So it's subtle. Okay.
Subtle difference. And the debate, oftentimes when we're talking about tying to federal law, there's the debate around the policy itself, but then there's the larger policy of to what extent do we tie to federal law.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
And so some of these, the largest one here, just to touch on some of the bigger ones, is the accelerated depreciation for equipment. And this is often tied with bonus depreciation, which started as a temporary policy in 01 or 02 and gets renewed often. It hasn't happened every year. And what that basically is under kind of a normal structure, if you will, a business buys a piece of equipment and they get to depreciate that over the life of the equipment. Now, to the extent, and kind of the default academic view is a straight line depreciation. If the machine is expected to last 10 years, then you depreciate it over 10 years. But generally, in federal law, you're allowed to depreciate things faster. They're a front-loaded depreciation where you get to depreciate more than the 10% in the first year. And so that's the accelerated turn. That's what that means. In recent, over the past two decades, well, we're going on two decades now, we've had bonus depreciation, which is basically a certain amount, and it's been as high as 100%, where it's just expensing. So all of the depreciation happens in that first year. And then that's generally what we refer to as expensing. And so in federal law, that's what that $400 million is that the business equipment is being depreciated faster than this academic straight line perspective. In kind of bouncing down to the tax credits, and that's an area where the state and the legislature has paid a lot of attention over the past 10 years. It also gets at the interaction between LRO and the policy committees. Back in 2009, the legislature put sunsets on all of the tax credits and put them into three bins such that every session, give or take, one-third of the tax credits would be reviewed by the legislature. And the key policy dynamic there was that under current law, they all had a sunset. So they were going away under current law, and that was reflected in the revenue forecast that gets updated every quarter. And over the past couple of sessions, so for three, including this one, the Legislative Revenue Office has been tasked with writing a report on analyzing the tax credits. And so we have, over the past two sessions, and will again this year, make ourselves available to the policy committees. The general approach for the House has been, we draft a default sunset extension bill, so every one of the credits gets extended by 6 years, and then those tax credits get assigned to the various policy committees, and then the policy committees will work on those to the extent that the committee would like to modify them, extend them, or allow them to sunset in any way, shape, or form in the way that the committee sees fit, and then they would be passed on to a joint committee on tax credits or tax expenditures. And there the process has been a little like Ways and Means, where there's been a tax credit budget and the tax credits get extended one way or the other. Now for this committee, last session is when we had most of the economic development ones. And this time I think the only one that might be tied to economic development for this group of tax credits is a cultural trust. And so what we've done there, Kyle Easton is the economist handling those this time, and then he'll be available to talk about that one as well as any others. So that we kind of have that formal process with the tax credits, and then to the extent the committee will be taking up other policies, whether it's enterprise zones or opportunity zones or any other issues, then we can help out there.
So just so I understand, so at the start of each biennium, there's a certain amount, one-third. And so from a standpoint of building the budget for that, and when the budget's built before we start the conversations, it's assumed they sunset. And then I'm just trying to understand from the standpoint of the income that we're predicting to do. So we assume they sunset, or we assume they don't sunset and they just continue on.
They are, for the ones that are included in the report?
Yeah.
Those all sunset in the middle of the biennium.
Oh, okay.
So the cultural trust, that under current law, the tax credit for those contributions goes away on 1/1/20. So under current law as it sits right now, a taxpayer would get that credit for 2019, but not for 2020. And then the way that plays out in our report is we have a cost to extend. So we have basically preliminary revenue impact amounts for all of these tax credits. And so for the group of tax credits that are scheduled to sunset this biennium, I believe the cost to extend is about $68 million. And so you have nine tax credits.
6 years.
$68 million for just the 1921 biennium. And so that's how that comes into play. And it depends on the tax credits. This time around, most of that is income tax credit. But that has often been the starting point of making no changes, just extending them 6 years would cost $68 million in this biennium.
Sure, Representative McLean.
Well, as you're talking about it, you're in the tax credit section. And so I do not see gain share, that process, where does that fit in?
Chair Lively, Rep. McLean, gain share is not a reduction in taxes for the taxpayers. It's an allocation. And so in that sense, it doesn't really fit the pure definition of a tax expenditure.
So what does it fit in? That's what I've been trying to find.
It is a way of reallocating general fund dollars on an automatic process.
So will it ever hit your list, Mr. Chair?
It doesn't meet this definition of a tax expenditure. So it certainly is an important policy for the Assembly to consider, and it has received attention in recent years. And that's where the kind of niche perspective of the tax expenditure is income or tax collections that are foregone completely from the state or the local government. So at the state level, it's mostly income taxes that don't go into the general fund, and that's kind of where gain share fits that viewpoint. But it also includes property taxes that don't go to local governments, and gain share is an allocation of income taxes to local governments.
Representative McLean, it certainly has been part of the economic development conversation. While it doesn't fit this definition, those of us that have been involved well know that gain share was an important part of some of the things we did in the past in order to facilitate economic development.
Mr. Chair, what I was trying to get is, I can't, you know, I understand it's an allocation of general funds, but I, you know, as you described it, you said the word property tax, you said the word income tax, and so I was trying to figure out just how it, you know, in your mind, or staff's mind, or as we're working through those conversations, how it fit into this system, because as you point out, it's reallocating what could have been a potential tax.
I guess I view it as income taxes that don't go into the general fund.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
They're income taxes that get diverted to the local governments.
Representative McEwen, did you?
Thank you, Chair Lively. And I apologize, I'm not sure this fits in the realm of economic development, but I see this as a target of opportunity to learn something. Foreign-derived intangible income. Can you explain that to me, please?
I can try. So for just a little bit of context, that is related to the federal tax changes that were passed into law, the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, back in December of 2017. Mm-hmm. So at a very high level perspective, the U.S. went from what we would call a worldwide system for corporate taxation to a territorial system. So under a worldwide system, the starting point is, okay, you're an Oregon or a U.S. corporation, we're going to tax all of your income wherever it's earned in the world. And then a key piece of that system was a policy that exempted some income. So if income were earned in a foreign country and it stayed in that foreign country, then there's a deferral of tax on that. You don't have to report that tax. So we start with literally the globe, and then all of the foreign income stays offshore, so we don't have to tax that. And this is where you might have heard terms like repatriation.
Repatriate.
Yes.
Okay.
Once it gets repatriated, then we'll tax it, but the tax on it is deferred until it gets repatriated. Under the territorial system, the starting point isn't the globe. It's just in the U.S. Now, there's still, and within that policy, the U.S. tax rate went from a top 35% down to 21%. Mm-hmm. The idea being that for profits being assigned or allocated to various countries, it reduces that incentive, because going from a marginal rate of 35% down to 21%, now we're not the highest rate. We're lower than some countries, so we'll bring it back.
Therein lies the incentive.
Right. So that's the backdrop there. And I apologize, but it only gets more complicated. There is still incentive for shifting profits around. And so there are two policies in play at the federal level. The one goes by the acronym of GILTI, G-I-L-T-I, Global Intangible Low Taxed Income. So that's basically.
How can you quantify something that's intangible?
Income from services, patents, trademarks. So you're not selling a good, you're selling an intangible service. or an intangible?
Intellectuals.
And so, and that's the kind that, that can be assigned to different countries, and it gets known as base erosion and profit shifting. So there's still an incentive for some companies to do that. And the FDII is a counterpart to the GILTI, where basically if you're exporting this income, then you get a deduction, because if the income is showing up in these other countries, we're going to tax it. It's an attempt to minimize this profit shifting around the countries.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
So one thing about some of these tax credits that I probably should have, but I didn't include on here, is many of these have already sunset, but they are still affecting the 1921 biennium, so they're included on the report here. So whether you're talking about the R&D tax credit, the qualified research activities tax credit, that was one that was allowed to sunset at the end of 2017. The qualified low-income community investments at the federal level, that's known as the New Markets Tax Credit. It's a piggyback of that. And then you have enterprise zone tax credits. So that's on the income side. And then when we get down to the property tax, we have two kinds, a full exemption and a partial exemption. And that's just refers to how much of the value can be exempted. And the driver here is really the strategic investment program. And that exempts investment above a certain threshold from taxation. So we have urban SIPs and we have rural SIPs. And for the urban, I believe it's $100 million. So the first $100 million pays tax, and then the investment above the $100 million is exempt. And then for the rural SIPs, we kind of have a tiered approach. That threshold is either 25, 50, or 100 million, depending on the amount of that investment. And then lastly there, the other taxes here, this relates to the vehicle privilege tax. And it just exempts certain modifications to that. Modifications to certain vehicles are not subject to the tax. And I believe they have to do with modifying a vehicle for disabled drivers or drivers with disabilities, as perhaps some other industrial uses. So this is kind of the list of what's on the plate right now. It's not really all, some of them have sunset, some have not. So stepping back from a larger point, which it sounds like it may be on your docket, are various tax incentives. And when economists look at these, we basically take a step back and the factors of production. So you have labor and capital. And so different states have different incentives or tax expenditures associated to one or both of those. And so if you're talking about an incentive related to labor, it might be a tax credit or deduction, an additional deduction or tax credit related to level of wages paid or number of employees. And they can be structured in a lot of different ways, but the intent there is to offset some of the cost or reduce the cost of labor in the production process. Similarly, you could have a similar process for capital. And either the capital can be a property tax exemption where the investment is there and it's not subject to the property tax, or you can have an investment tax credit where investments of certain types, whether it's size or sector, will enable the taxpayer to claim an income tax credit. So one recent one that we have had for Oregon is the electronic commerce zone tax credit. That was basically an investment tax credit of a certain kind. And those are really the flavors. They can get into a lot of different structures. Business Oregon follows these things closely, so I would assume that you'll be talking to them throughout the session. But at a high level, it all comes down to an incentive related to labor or capital, one way or the other. And then beyond that, I mean, you can have those, and then how they're structured, focus on either attracting, a lot of the common ones are attracting business or business retention and expansion programs, where you focus on businesses within the state and help them expand, or if there's some sort of impediment to them expanding, to the extent that the tax policy can mitigate those, then that would be a direction to go. You can focus on those. You can focus on the comparative advantages that Oregon has in certain sectors or certain areas. But one way or another, it usually comes down to one of those two incentives. There's a special case. I see marijuana is up on the agenda, and we have a different economist focusing on marijuana taxes. And that is something, as the committee is aware, of a unique situation where simply the legalization of the product now is opening up opportunities, and there are probably myriad regulations or ordinances that the committee might consider to address some of that. And so that steps away a little bit from the tax policy, but gets into some of the regulation or other aspects.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chris, for the summary. So as an Economic Development Committee, I think as we look at this, the question that's in front of me anyway is, what's the bang for the buck? And I think in recent years, we've gotten much more rigorous about attaching actually outcome measures to certainly the tax credits. But I wonder if you could just talk for a little bit about how we look at those outcomes and how we measure the effectiveness of any of these vis-a-vis the original intent.
Chair Lively, Representative Marsh. The key to that is always data. So to evaluate those, we can either look at academic research that's out there in the field. We can look at other states. And inevitably, it comes down to gathering information. And that gets to be one of the things that we've learned is, as committees and as the legislature considers these policies, the value of incorporating at some level and in some way the collection of data to come back and evaluate and fine-tune the programs. Even within that, there is the purpose for a tax credit. And that's what we've really focused on over the past few years in evaluating an incentive, the bang for the buck. How do you define the buck? Are you looking for Oregon to have a larger market share in a certain sector? Are you looking to have more businesses or local expansion? And defining those purposes and then setting up some kind of process or data collection mechanism. And it doesn't have to be everything all at once. We can often go along with just simple data collection. But inevitably, you start getting into some fiscal costs and collecting the information, who's responsible for following up on that. And we can rely to some extent on information already collected, whether it's employees because of the unemployment insurance program, other kind of leverage other government programs to gather that information. But that's really kind of key, defining the purpose of a policy, how long it may be to get there, and setting up reasonable expectations too. Sometimes these things can take a while to kick in. It isn't necessarily the case that something can be passed and then there's a transformation overnight.
Right. Representative Barreto.
Mr. Chair, so on a simpler part of this, do you track the number of businesses that leave the state and those that come into the state annually?
Once a business that leaves the state is tricky because we don't know, it's hard to know if they left the state. You can have a business that merges with another business, and the challenge of a business leaving the state is they're not showing up anymore. So that could be any number of reasons. Maybe they went out of business,
right?
Or maybe they moved. It requires a lot of other legwork. They're not showing up. Maybe it really depends on the circumstances on Oregon's radar screen in terms of tax forms. So that gets to be tricky.
So kind of a follow-up. So if a business leaves the state and they just quit, I mean, basically they're physically, they've left, you know, they don't have to give notice to the state saying, hey, we're leaving and don't send us we won't be filling out a tax form next year.
Right.
Okay.
Questions? Anything else, Chris?
That I think I kind of touched on it. I mean, the other concepts, whether you're talking about trying to build economic diversity or building on existing agglomeration forces and so forth, I think those are all issues that'll be tackled. They don't always necessarily intersect with tax policy, but economic development, I think, generally would be viewed as broader than tax policy.
So I would, go ahead, Rick.
I have one more question. So over in LeGrand, we had Boise Cascade there. They just sold to another company called Millworks. And so Boise Cascade probably would have been paying taxes in Oregon. Millworks is now headquartered down in Emmett. However, they bought the facilities and still put out product there. With Nexus, with Idaho then, do they, say they ran all of their sales through their Emmett location, with Nexus, would they be required to pay a certain amount of Oregon income tax also?
Could be. Now, with the notion of Nexus, it gets divided into two categories, whether we're talking about tangible personal property, basically goods, or services. And so if we're talking about goods, tangible products, there are some federal law that limits the ability to tax companies. If all they're doing is selling into the state and they really don't have strong other connections, then they might be protected by a federal law that says Oregon can't tax them. This is public law 86272. For tangible or intangible services, then we get into issues of economic nexus. And last session we moved from, we incorporated a market-based sourcing where they would be. I think you're talking about a goods producing company.
Right, goods produced here, but maybe distributed or sold outside from another location.
Right. Well, if they're located in Oregon, then they would have nexus.
They get shipped from, yeah.
Okay. Representative Wallen.
Thank you. When the credits are given or the exemptions or deductions, subtractions, the different things, I guess I want to push the question a little bit further than what Representative Marsh asked. Would you ever, have you ever been directed to keep track of what the subsidies did in terms of developing certain sectors, or if not, what department would do that, and would you need that direction from statute in order to keep those kind of statistics?
Chair Lively, Representative Wallen, there's always interest in that. Most of the information that we work with is through the Department of Revenue and the tax returns. We have access to that information. And while there is a fair amount of information on the tax return, it's not all-encompassing. And when we get to issues of employment, so now we're talking about the Department of Employment, and we can run into limitations of the agencies sharing information with each other. They each have very strict confidentiality requirements. And so we almost get into a logistical question about sharing the information and tracking it. And there are, it's not a topic without concern, pros and cons about tracking the companies with number of employees and that kind of information. So it's always of interest, and we try to figure out ways that aren't too burdensome on the companies, but do provide some level of information. And that's where the point that I've tried to stress over the past couple of sessions is that it's not an all or nothing kind of situation. That some information can point in the right, can point policymakers in the right direction about whether something is generally working or not working. And then, as you know, you hear from the public.
Thank you, Chair. Just quickly to follow up on that, aren't there instances where some of these exclusions, deductions, subtractions, credits, exemptions, however you want to call them, are tied to a certain level of job retention or job creation, in which case you would have to have access to that information?
That's correct. Some of them are tied to those, and then it gets to be a matter of enforcement. Mm-hmm. And there, that might be a better question for the Department of Revenue, in that it would probably be related to an audit, and they're generally relating tax law. I think that would be connected there. And Business Oregon, I know, tracks some of this information, but I don't know what authority they have to actually enforce anything. they collect the information. And so I think that's something you'll be talking, I imagine you'll be getting into that in a little more detail, exactly what those agencies can or can't do.
Got it.
With respect to the enforcement.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to wander too far afield.
But that's some of the types of questions we'll have as we go through and talk about these. So the point of this isn't to make you all tax expert, but just to look at the bottom line. And what we're talking about is it being effectively invested. Are we getting the return on an investment? Especially when we're going to be asked for other economic development incentives potentially. Just trying to get our hands around it. Having worked in economic development, I mean, that was always the struggle, is how do you document indeed? Because many companies would say they were going to hire a certain number of people. And so both, if you could document, in some cases you could, but enforcing then became, if something happened, how do you enforce it? So locally enterprise zones are managed, and so they're responsible. But I think that points up one of the areas we need to, as we're going forward, think about. Because if we're expecting the Economic Development Department, all these incentives, investments, to return something to the citizens, we ought to be able to somehow ensure that they're doing that. But so that's part of this conversation. Any other questions? Okay.
And I mean, the enterprise zone is a geographic-based perspective, and then you enter, you jump into questions of locations within the state, and the data becomes vital there.
And at some point, we'll have some more conversation about those specifically, and a couple of enterprise zone managers here to talk to them. But that's an age-old question and issue. But we just know we'll have more opportunities this session to talk about potentially other incentives. And in some cases, since I've been here, some of these incentives sunset, and then we come back to review them again to see if there's some things have changed to talk about. And the solar is one of those examples where we've had incentives, haven't had examples, but now we're talking about again providing this. Not to suggest we don't do those things, only that as things change, we have to have those conversations. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. And our pen folks
are arriving.
Yes, okay. Perfect timing.
Okay, so we'll continue our informational hearing. So next, we have representatives, and I see they've arrived in the room, so timing's everything, Senator Rome, from the Pacific Northwest Economic Region to discuss the organization and its trade and innovation initiatives. So welcome, Senator Roblin, your guests, and we heard on the floor this morning they were introduced, and I know they've been busy since they've been there, but if you'd all like to come forward and introduce yourselves for the record. And thank you, Senator Roblin, for helping put all this together.
It's always great to come back to a great committee like this.
Thank you. We appreciate that.
He's a former representative.
So for the record, Arne Roblin, State Senator, District 5. Oregon Coast, I like to call it. I give a little bit to the North Coast and a little bit to the South Coast to other people, but the Mid-Coast and South and North ends of it are pretty much my district. Parts of seven counties. And we're here actually to talk a little bit about PENWAR. As many know, I'm past president of PENWAR. Last year, I was the president and had the opportunity to make a lot of the visits that they're doing right now. So our contingent is coming, goes to every one of the 10 jurisdictions. So for those who don't know, PENWAR is made up of the five western states of Alaska, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana, and the five western provinces and territories of Canada, British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Northwest Territories, and the Yukon. And so our winter meeting this last year was in the Yukon, which was really fun to go to. Good to have winter meetings in a real winter place. And you find out that the Yukon is the driest, the city, is one of the driest cities in all of Canada. So it's because of the way the stuff does. They don't even get that much snow, but once they get it, it stays there for a long time. And PENWAR was started in 1991 as a way for cross-border conversations to take place and economic development, because we are intimately tied together. If you really look at our trading partners, Canada and the U.S. are number one or two all the time, along with China and others. But it's really that relationship across the border. And past presidents from Obama on back have indicated that the number one cross-border organization that they work with is PENWAR, because If you live in Washington, they worked out a thing a few years ago to have their driver's license get them across the border instead of having to use a passport. We continue to work on ways to do that. They just started air traffic between Seattle and Victoria, which had been Vancouver, which had gone away for a long time and is now back. It's how do we get people and things to go back and forth across that border to enhance the economic development of both regions. When it comes to agriculture, we share all sorts of things. When it comes to resources, we share all sorts of things. One of the big issues, and they'll talk a little about, I'm helping get a message to Congress that we need to get the tariffs gone. And we need to pass legislation that brings us back to that cooperation that Canada and the U.S. have had forever. And you'll hear some stories about we have all these cars, they need to be repurposed into and recycled into steel. They go across the border, and I'll let Larry talk about that. But with me, we have the new president of Penwar from Saskatchewan. We have parliamentary member of British Columbia, and we'll let them all introduce themselves and really have a conversation. We'd love to answer any questions you might have, but that interaction between our countries, tourism, we have a lot of committees within and work groups that work all the time, from invasive species to carbon to Representative Lively's actually brought a couple of those things. We had the big meeting in Portland a couple of years ago, and we had a real conversation about carbon and those kinds of things. So it is another way to get more people looking at the same issues and coming up with new solutions. And I really appreciate the friends here that I've made over the last number of years in the Penwar region and look forward to sharing some of that stuff with you. So with that, I'll turn it over to the current president of Penwar to say a few words.
Thank you very much, Senator. It's a pleasure to be here today, and my name is Larry Doak. I'm a member of the Legislative Assembly in Saskatchewan. I have another title. I don't advertise it a lot, but I am the Legislative Secretary for Government Relations, First Nations, Métis, and Northern Affairs, which keeps me very busy. We're glad to be here today for Penwar. And first of all, I'd just like to give just a few brief stats, if I could, on Saskatchewan. Saskatchewan has 40% of the arable land in Canada. And we're the largest exporter of pulse crops to Asia. We're the largest producer of potash in the world. And we are landlocked and depend on rail and road to get our product to market. This is one reason Penwar has been very important to us. We need to work together as a region to ensure that we can access growing markets in Asia for our ag products. Penwar has also worked diligently on the tariffs. Now the tariffs, the steel and aluminum tariffs, in Saskatchewan, in the capital of Regina, we have a plant there, it's called Evraz. They're a steel manufacturing plant. They make rolled steel and flat iron and pipe. So the pipe for the Keystone or any pipeline for that matter most likely comes out of there, and it's all different dimensions. So as Senator Roblin said, they buy crushed vehicles from Idaho, Oregon, Montana, North Dakota, and they pay a 25% duty on those crushed cars, or crushed vehicles, when they come in. Then they manufacture it into whatever product they are, then we sell it back to you, and then we add a 25% tariff on it. So it's not good. In fact, just last or 2 weeks ago when we were in Idaho, we had a trailer manufacturer there that uses high-grade aluminum for his trailers and whatever, and this is good for us, bad for you, but he's thinking seriously of moving his plant to Canada. First the dollar exchange, and then the tariffs on aluminum, it just doesn't make him, he can't compete anymore. So they're not happy. So anything that you've gained in the USMCA through in the ag section, you're losing it all in tariffs. So there's no gain. So we would like all the support we can get from every state, every province, to get these tariffs removed, both sides of the border. The second thing is the invasive species. On our east side of the province of Saskatchewan is the province of Manitoba, and they have their biggest lake there is called Lake Winnipeg. 6 years ago, Lake Winnipeg did not have any muscles at all in it. This past spring in 2018, there was a, when the ice went out, the wind came up, blew the ice in. It pushed in a windrow of mussels 3 feet high, two city blocks. So they're there, and we're doing all we can to protect it from getting into our lakes. In the U.S., you have some federal funding that helps you along. In Canada, we don't have any federal funding to help us, so each province is doing their own thing. But I encourage you, don't let the ball drop here. You have to stay involved in this. We're the only region in North America, I believe, that doesn't have mussels. So I encourage you to be very aggressive on that fact. I know your neighbors, Idaho and Montana, are very aggressive on it. So as a region, that's how we can keep them out. At least we're going to try. So I thank you for your time today.
Thank you for being here.
Hi, and my name is Rick Lumack. I'm a member of the Legislative Assembly from British Columbia, and I've had the pleasure of being involved with Penwire over the last year and a half. And specifically, I'm a parliamentary secretary of technology, and a parliamentary secretary, I'm an elected person, and that is a role that the premier gave to me. And basically, it's kind of a junior minister kind of role, and it's a champion of technology, really. And I see huge opportunities for collaboration, especially within the Cascadia corridor. Last year, I was involved with the Penwar Innovation Working Group. There's a number of working groups in Penwar, many different topics, and we have the opportunity during the conference in the summer to showcase some of the collaborative efforts that we're doing. And last year in Spokane, I got to talk a little bit about or help organize a discussion around big data and how that the kind of data that's available for companies out there. And I heard a lot of people say how, wow, I didn't know that was available, and what companies can do with it. And, you know, so companies are looking for regulation and some consistency on how they can use data in a safe way for the public. And there's some really good opportunities for discussion at these conferences in the summer around topics like that. Another one was blockchain that we talked about, and a lot of people probably don't know a lot about blockchain, so but it's something that you'll start hearing a lot more about, I think. And then another great opportunity we have is to collaborate is around the Cascadia Innovation Corridor. There has been a conference running for the last 3 years around the Cascadia Innovation Corridor. And in this last conference up in Vancouver this year, a number of areas are being looked into to develop basically a three-year plan on how to grow the economy around all these different areas. And you see our own Matt Morrison is involved in the one on the bottom right there. So there's great opportunities here as well for Oregon to be involved in you know, at the conference last year, I did a talk on high-speed rail, and I hope that all of you know the tremendous economic opportunity that exists in connecting our region through high-speed rail. I think the estimate is like 200,000 jobs and incredible economic growth that'll when linking our regions together. Because right now, one of the challenges we have is that although we're close, we're not well linked. And if you look on websites like LinkedIn to see how connected we are, we're more well connected to New York. In Vancouver, we're more well connected to New York than we are to Seattle. And even less connected to Portland. So there's a lot of opportunity there, I think. And I guess the last thing I'll say is, you know, I know we're all doing things now around climate action, and that's another thing that, you know, perhaps at the next conference, there could be a discussion around that. What are the best practices? What are people doing? In BC, we want to grow our economy and grow a low carbon economy. And that's how we're framing it. We're doing a lot of work around carbon reduction, but also a lot of work around innovation in a lot of different areas around building codes and transportation and many other areas. So I look forward to seeing as many of you as I can at the next conference. Thank you.
Okay. Is Jeff here?
Jeff.
Jeff, here.
Jeff. Hi, for the record, Representative Jeff Morris from Washington State. I'm going to talk about Capitals Competing for Capital, which is a new offering from PennWar. We did a pilot program last year where we took 20 legislators and staff down to the Bay Area for 2 days and really focus on a couple of items in particular, the first one being getting their mind around what the new technologies are in the telephony space, 5G versus 4G, edge computing, artificial intelligence or machine learning, and how that's all going to work together as a mosaic in the future, because there's not a silver bullet that's going to solve all of our broadband needs for all parts of our diverse economies we have across the different PennWar jurisdictions. And then secondly, to see inside the decision-making processes these companies use to make decisions about whether to invest in Malaysia, Australia, Oregon, Alberta, because there's a different fundamentals where they're looking at rates of return on the capital they're going to invest in this infrastructure and how fast they're going to get paid back. And then more importantly, as a secondary issue, for the budget, for the money that's budgeted for PennWar jurisdictions, and I'm going to throw out some hypothetical numbers, but let's say there's $1 billion of investment coming to PennWar in the next 12-month capital budget cycle collectively for the industry, and they only get $500 million actually put on the ground. Where does that other $500 million go? Does it go within the jurisdiction that it couldn't get put on the ground? Does it go to another jurisdiction within PennWar? Does it go to offshore somewhere where they can land that money within the fiscal budget period that they have? What is that decision-making process? I know in Washington State, we've seen companies that can't get 5G permits in Seattle push that money to Spokane because Spokane's thought out their local permitting process to actually put that money on the ground. So they've been the beneficiary of slow processes in other jurisdictions, as an example. And so sharing best practices and coming up with a metric for the region where we can start to measure in kind of gross dollars, how much money did you slate for PennWar to be invested in these different technologies and how much was that landed? And then have a regional discussion about why it wasn't landed and what we can do to solve those problems. But we're gonna be recruiting for a new class for C3 for this coming September. We're kind of roughly slating the second week after Labor Day. To take 20 to 35 legislators down and do the same thing. We go through some of the big R&D facilities. And if you've heard of terms like latency and broadband, which is a hard thing to describe, but when you actually see two robots sit there try to balance a ball on a table using 4G, and then you do it with 5G, and how much tighter that ball spins together, it really shows you what latency looks like in a real application. So getting that kinesthetic experience of touching this, some of these technologies really helps you envision how it's going to play out in our communities. And all of you have been through, I see some very few familiar faces around this committee, but the Legislative Energy Horizon Institute is in its 9th class, I think, this year. We've had 267 legislators go through the institute. That's 16,000 hours of time that legislators have donated to learn more about energy infrastructure, how it works, how it's built, and how those infrastructures are run between market and regulatory forces are the outcomes of the 60-hour executive course we do with the University of Idaho and the Department of Energy and Natural Resources Canada, which is their partner across the border. The idea is that if you're passionate about energy policy, but you're maybe a flower shop owner one day or a fireman, and all of a sudden you're in trying to decide what connectivity standards or what the distributed generation rules are going to be on the distribution system, it can be quite daunting with a sea of lobbyists to look at. The idea here is to give you enough fundamental background that you can ask questions, knowing you're not going to be asking a silly question during a committee hearing. But also that when people come and talk to you about some of these problems, they actually have a discussion with you knowing that you may not always agree with them, but they don't have to show pictographs about how these systems work in the 15 minutes they have in your office before the next appointment comes in, that they can have a discussion about what their problems are and not have to describe how their infrastructure works. And that's the key thing we're trying to get, is to get people past or give them that knowledge of how the infrastructure works so you can kind of focus on the best solutions for your constituents to the problems. A lot of the graduates, it's very intense. I won't say there's no fun involved, but we value your time, and it's a very intense download of a lot of really quality speakers And I'll say that we give a very well-rounded perspective. So I always say at the beginning of the class that we're an equal opportunity offender. You're going to hear something you don't like in one of the presentations, just to make sure that we do get a well-rounded perspective and have a bunch of different viewpoints talking about some of these different energy challenges that we're presented with today. I think I'll wrap up with that. I'll go through these. Here's the dates for the 2019 Legislative Institute, July 6th through 9th at Richland, Washington at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, and then October 24th to 26th in Washington, D.C. Is the balance of the 30 hours we finish up the course back there. One of the things that we do is that for PennWare participants, PennWare covers all the travel and tuition costs, so what you donate is your time. And we value that. And so, we have a scholarship amount to cover kind of air or getting out to these events and the hotel and so forth, and the meals are covered on site.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Matt Morrison, Executive Director of PennWare from the Seattle Secretariat. And I'll cover just quickly a few things on our trade file. We have a very active trade and economic development work group, and this has been a terrible year for me with NAFTA and NAFTA 2.0. And
sure.
I can't tell you. I've been in this job maybe 20 years, but I've never seen a year like the last 12 months from a perspective of U.S.-Canada. You know, Canada is our biggest trading partner. They buy more than China, the U.K., and the rest of Europe combined, and here we are putting tariffs on them. And anyway, it's astounding. So we, as Senator Roblin mentioned, we do feel it's very important that the USMCA, which is the NAFTA 2.0, gets ratified for by Congress, because it's not implemented until it's ratified by Congress and by Canada and Mexico. So we are anxious to see that happen. These are some of the statistics here. Oregon sells $2.8 billion in goods and services to Canada, representing about 98,000 jobs. That's pretty big. It's a major part of Oregon's economy, so it's important. And sometimes people don't recognize that. So besides getting the USMCA ratified, the president put tariffs on steel and aluminum from Canada and Mexico, and then Canada and Mexico retaliated with steel and aluminum tariffs on US steel and a bunch of other things, a lot of agricultural projects, produce. So we're anxious to see those repealed, and we think that can happen. So we would appreciate support from all of the U.S. states to their congressional delegation to say this is something that's important to us. Some of the key provisions if you're interested, there's a lot of information on the USMCA, but the highlights, I guess, for PennWare, Canadian dairy and wheat policy changes, which do impact Oregon dairy producers. Not as much selling dairy products into Canada as selling dairy products to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. So it's an agreement that says that Canada cannot, can't undercut in an unfair way overseas. And that's the big one there. Dispute settlement mechanism, intellectual property rights, which were not covered in the old NAFTA, government procurement, and digital trade, which wasn't 1994. There was no internet, and there's a lot of digital trade happening. And the environment. These are the big issues, and there will be quite a discussion in Congress about the current USMCA, and you'll probably be hearing more about it as Congress takes that up and begins looking at it. But with the Trade Promotion Act of 2015, which is called the FAST Act or Fast Track, Congress has to do an up or down vote. They really can't amend or change the USMCA by the legislation they passed in 2015. So you'll hear more about it. And as I mentioned, the tariffs, we're really hoping that and calling for them to be removed. We've done lots of letters to the president and to the Secretary of Commerce and to Robert Lighthizer about this. And we also have a letter from 26 different national agriculture groups that are very concerned with the tariffs, and especially as we look into this coming 2019 year, big impacts on tariffs in Mexico and Canada, because a lot of our produce has been going there. So this is our call to action. We think this is important. We certainly would like your committee to be aware of it, and we hope that there will be a resolution that you could consider in your committee. Then, Larry, you want to talk about Saskatoon?
Yes. So this year coming up, the summit will be in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, July 21st to the 25th. I'm inviting all of you to come. As one of our ministers said, it's Paris on the prairies, right? So we hope it'll have a strong ag element to it. I think at the University of Saskatchewan, we do lots of things, whether it's in food security, crop production, all those kinds of things. So we're looking forward to a great summit. Hopefully, we're going to have a potash tour, a potash mine tour, possibly a tour down to the CCS plant at Boundary Dam 3. So I invite all of you to attend. And it's only a day and a half drive. It's nice.
It's not bad. No.
And I just want to say, I checked before I came here, and everybody except Melissa hours. Is a member of PENWAR. All of your names are on the list, and Melissa's welcome to come to PENWAR. But all the rest of you are already members, because like NCSL and the others, we pay the dues as a body for every member to be a part of it. You don't have to be a delegate to go to and attend. Every state and province gets delegates, but many of the people who come are not the delegates, they just are members, and they recognize that it's an important thing. And getting engaged in one of the many different work groups that we have is, I think, really important, because this organization is more run by the people, us, than just any organization I've been involved with, because it's our ideas that come to the forefront, and it's our ideas that we actually really have conversations about. So I would encourage people to get involved and find that niche you want to get engaged in and get to know people on both sides of the borders. It's really an amazing opportunity.
Questions, comments? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. MP Doak, I agree with you that 25% going two ways is, I think in your words, not a good thing. And I would apologize if our 25% was a bargaining tactic to come back and ask you for help. I'm not even sure that's a good way to negotiate. With that said, is there hope that the new NAFTA is going to in some way diminish the tariffs that our two countries are now imposing on each other when we have one, really, only one North American market?
Well, I don't know who will back down first. But I know that, I think I can safely say that the ratification of the agreement is based on the tariffs being dropped. So hopefully that will happen. I know the president, once it's done, I think it's closing in here pretty quick with the date. So I would hope that that's what would happen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. I just comment that I have, as not only a member of PENWAR but also a participant, always found my Canadian colleagues open to honest, true, and candid discussions, and willing to work towards problem solutions. And I thank you for those efforts. I hope that we are able to resolve our trade differences. And I would just, my own personal editorial, I am unaware that Canada was ever dumping steel here in the United States. I didn't believe that the steel pricing problem was a Canadian one. And appreciate very much your appearance here today.
Thank you.
I might just make a comment. You spoke about, I think, landing capital, the whole time it takes for us to make decisions so that they can make the investments. And I guess historically in economic development, that's been a huge issue. And it appears with technology that's only become more severe because the timing involved in those companies being able to make decisions to make those investments in infrastructure. So I appreciate the efforts that are going on there. I know that's something we'll talk about again here, because from a standpoint of the state and how quick we can react as a state, that's always critical, because that capital is going to go somewhere in a short period of time.
Thank you. Thank you for that statement. One of the things that we offered with the faculty of the class is we actually had a couple of Wall Street analysts come in and talk to the legislators about how they evaluate these companies from the other side. That was very illuminating, I think, into, in a sense, how do the people that grade these companies grade them from that Wall Street perspective, and what their thinking was and how they were investing in them. One of the best presenters we had actually was from, lives in Alberta, actually, but works for Deloitte, and was just really talking about how one of their clients had pushed out, I think it was like a million and a half handsets in 30 days, and I think it may have been Malaysia, and the fact they did that all in the Amazon model with the just-in-time inventory, as opposed to what we see here in the North America with storefronts and, yep, and how we push technology out, what a difference that made into getting it deployed. So there was even lessons in some of that as well.
Sure. Any further questions or comments? Again, thank you very much. We'll see how we can support the efforts. You're going to be commended for those efforts, and appreciate your frustration with the changes in the near term and getting them resolved so we can get on with this, but we'll see what we can do. Representative McPhail.
Thank you, Chair. I just don't want to lose sight of the fact that for you to take time out of your busy schedules as MLAs from Canada to come here and join us is really something I want to acknowledge. We know how busy we all are, and time is everything that we do. So thank you for the work that you're doing in first of all, rising up in the ranks in Penwar, taking on the task that you've taken on and coming here to join us. And I know Representative Morris is here, too, out of his busy schedule. And that's hard to do. It's a wonderful organization. I think there's tremendous value as an elected official in a state to move beyond the borders of your state and get outside of your bubble and see what's going on, not only in Lehigh with people from all over the United States who represent East Coast, West Coast, the central part of the United States, and what's going on with power in their regions, but to have an opportunity to meet our Canadian brothers and sisters and learn how your system works and how we can interact and do a better job of moving things across our border more efficiently. So thank you for your time. I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Thank you, Senator Roblin.
I was just gonna, as we leave, if you ever have a chance and you get to know Mr. Glumak, Shrek would not be what it is today if it had not been for his technological ability to make the clothing and cloth and all the other kind of things that you see in that movie. So interesting technology people amongst us as well.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close the information hearing. Is there any other business to come before this committee today? Doesn't sound like it, so I'm going to adjourn. Don't get used to adjourning early, but...